did archaeology and ancient earth history, international banking, internal subversion, terrorism, the history of taxation, U.S. foreign policy, the science and politics and cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, and the United Nations. Some of his previous better-known works include Discovery of Noah's Ark, Moles in High Places, The Open Gates of Troy, No Place to Hide, World Without Cancer, The Capitalist Conspiracy, More Deadly Than War, The Grand Design, The Great Prison Break, and The Fearful Master on the United Nations. Griffin is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communications. In preparation for writing this book, he enrolled in the College of Financial Planning located in Denver. His goal was not only to become a professional financial planner, but to better understand the real world of investments and money markets. And he obtained his CFP designation, Certified Financial Planner, in 1989. He's a recipient of the Telly Award for Excellence in Television Production. He is a contributing editor to the New American Magazine and is president of American Media, a publishing and video production company in Southern California, and is the author of the new book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which we will speak of tonight. I'm proud to present to you Mr. G. Edward Griffin.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Well, you really do have to get close to this thing, don't you? Who's the newspaper guy that's going to cover this report? It better be good.
He is.
Okay, is everybody ready?
Ready. Okay.
Ready. Okay, here we go. It was the first century B.C. in the tiny kingdom of Phrygia that there lived an obscure philosopher by the name of Epictetus. And it was Epictetus who said, appearances are of four kinds. Things either are as they appear to be, or they neither are nor appear to be, or they are but do not appear to be, or they are not and yet appear to be. I hope you all got that. When I read that statement, I thought for sure that if Epictetus were alive today, he would probably be a Harvard professor of banking and economics. But then I discovered that no, he actually is alive today. I just discovered evidence of this last week when I stopped in at the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis. I picked up a brochure and I was glancing through it, and it was the section describing, you know, M1, M2, and M3, all the different money aggregates, and here's the beginning of the explanation, and it was written by Epictetus. It says, the Federal Reserve has developed a number of money and credit measures that unavoidably represent a compromise among various alternative concepts that takes into account the availability of the necessary raw data and the not always clear empirical evidence from statistical tests relating various money and credit measures to other economic variables. So, Epictetus lives. Well, actually, what Epictetus did was what is so commonly done by the experts in the field, is he took a relatively simple concept, but by the time he was through explaining it, we had no idea what he was saying. All he was saying is that appearances can sometimes be deceiving. By the time he was through explaining the four ways in which appearances can sometimes be deceiving, we ourselves were deceived. And I thought that that would be perhaps a track to run on. Because, ladies and gentlemen, if there is anything in this world that is an appearance that is deceiving, it is the Federal Reserve. In fact, it is one of those appearances of the fourth kind, which, according to Epictetus, are those things which are not and yet appear to be. So I'm going to use that as kind of a little hook on the topic, a handle, if you will, and we'll come back to it from time to time and see if it doesn't help us get a little better understanding of this topic, because we're talking, or will be talking, about things which are not at all what they appear to be. I did my research on this topic, I came to the startling conclusion that the Federal Reserve System should not be audited, because my conclusion was it needed to be abolished, not audited. You know, I'm sure that if they audited the Fed, they would probably find a few minor improprieties here and there. But basically, I think they would find that the Fed is doing exactly what it says it is doing. And the scam is really out in the open. We don't need an audit to discover the real scam. All we have to do is just understand it. And I came to the conclusion that there were seven reasons that the Federal Reserve System should be abolished. I'd like to read them for you now. I phrased them in the most concise and perhaps even shocking form that I could, so that you wouldn't miss the point. Number one, it is incapable of accomplishing its stated objectives. Two, it is a cartel operating against the public interest. Three, it is the supreme instrument of usury. Four, it generates our most unfair tax. Five, it encourages war. Six, it destabilizes the economy. And seven, it is an instrument of totalitarianism. Now, I don't know what you think about those seven statements. Apparently, a lot of you folks already agree with them. But I hope that there are some skeptics here this evening. Otherwise, I'm the preacher talking to the choir again. In fact, I know from experience that there always are quite a few skeptics, and I'm delighted for that. And I know that those of you who are new to this topic, you're probably thinking, I wonder if those are really true. So time does not permit me to really fully develop these points this evening, but I would like to splash around in the first four of them and show you just a little bit of the evidence that is available to support those conclusions. And I think you would agree that if any one of them could actually be demonstrated to be true, it would be reason enough to abolish the Federal Reserve System. Well, I think the best place to begin is not really at the beginning, but in the middle of the story where the action was. And that takes us to Jekyll Island. Now, those of you who understand a little bit about this story, you know why the title, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Actually, I had a lot of fun with that title when I dreamed it up, because I had this idea that somebody might see the book someday and think it was a sequel to Jurassic Park and might be tempted to pick it up and read it for that reason. But actually, the title has a deeper meaning because it tells us something about the Federal Reserve System. It was on Jekyll Island, which is a real island off the coast of Georgia. It was on that island in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was conceived, at a highly secret meeting that took place there. And the secrecy of that meeting is significant. We'll explore the fact that it was secret. Then we'll take a look at why the secrecy, and what is it that they were trying to hide. And when we answer that question and realize what it was, we'll know something about the Federal Reserve System that is not taught in our textbooks. In 1910, Jekyll Island was completely owned by a small group of millionaires from New York, people such as J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller, people of that caliber. This is where their families came to spend the winter months. And they had a very plush clubhouse there, a magnificent structure, which was the center of their social activities. They called it the Jekyll Island Club. And by the way, you can still visit that island. It's been purchased now by the state of Georgia, and the clubhouse has been restored. And you can stop in, as I did, and have lunch there, the millionaire's lunch. I highly recommend it. Very good. And you'll also visit those cottages around this clubhouse, which is where the families stayed, or many of them at least. And of course, to use the word cottages is a laugh, because they're huge mansions. The one that I remember touring, I think the guide said that there were 14 bathrooms in there. You have to remember the entry when to have one bathroom was a pretty big event. But anyway, that's not the important part of the story. The important part is that this is where the wealthy came to be in seclusion. The system was created. So let me tell you that story just as it unfolded. It was November of 1910 when Senator Nelson Aldrich sent his private railroad car to the New Jersey Railroad Station. And there was in readiness, awaiting his arrival and the arrival of six other men. They'd all been told to come under conditions of great secrecy. They were told to come one at a time, as unobtrusively as possible, not to be seen together, and if they should show up together, not to recognize each other, not to talk to each other. They were to avoid newspaper reporters at all costs, because they were well recognized, they would have been recognized, and they were to shun reporters. One of the men, his name was Paul Warburg, carried a shotgun in a case, so that if he had been stopped, he would have been asked, where are you going? And he could have said, I'm going duck hunting. And we find from his biographers and his family later that this man never fired a gun in his whole life. It was just part of the general deception. And even after they got on board this private car, they continued this pattern. They were told to use first names only, to avoid last names. And several of them even abandoned their first names and used code names. And the reason for that was that they were afraid that the servants on board the train would recognize who they were, and that through that avenue, word would leak out to the outside world, and exposure would completely defeat the purpose of their meeting. Oh, they traveled for two nights and a day in this car on a 1,000-mile journey southward to Brunswick, Georgia. There they took a ferry across the inland strait to Jekyll Island, and for the next 9 days they sat around a table and worked out, hammered out all of those important details of what eventually became the Federal Reserve Act. When they were done, they returned to the railroad car, back to New Jersey, back to New York. And for many years thereafter, they denied that such a meeting ever took place. It wasn't until after the Federal Reserve System was formed, after it was firmly entrenched and had become accepted, even revered as a great American institution, only then did they begin to speak openly about what happened there. They wrote books on it, gave interviews to newspaper reporters, wrote magazine articles and that kind of thing. And so many years later, it's possible to go back into the public record and piece together the story of Jekyll Island. Well, who were these seven men? I've already mentioned a couple of them. The first one was Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was the Republican whip in the Senate at that time. He was also chairman of the National Monetary Commission. Now, that was the committee of Congress that was created for the purpose of investigating ways to reform banking. Banking reform was the big clamor in Congress at that time, because the public was greatly concerned over two things. Bank failures had been going on, they were worried about that, but they were primarily worried about the concentration of financial power into the hands of a few large banks and investment houses in New York on Wall Street. This is what they called the money trust in those days. And quite a few politicians had been elected to office on their campaign promise to break the grip of the money trust. It was a popular theme. And one of the purposes of the National Monetary Commission was to propose legislation to Congress for means of breaking the grip of the money trust. And Aldrich was chairman of that committee. He was also a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., which means, of course, that eventually he became the grandfather of Nelson Rockefeller, our vice president, who became our vice president. Remember, his name is Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller. He got his middle name from his grandfather. Also present at the meeting was Abraham Piat Andrew, who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Frank Vanderlip was there. He was the president of the National City Bank of New York, which was the largest of all the banks in the country at that time, representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Henry Davison was there. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there. He was president of the First National Bank of New York, which was another one of the giants. Also, there was Benjamin Strong, who was head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And Strong, incidentally, became the first head of the Federal Reserve System 3 years later, when it was finally enacted into law. And finally, there was the fellow with the shotgun, Paul Warburg. He was definitely there. He was perhaps the most important one of the bunch because of his knowledge of banking. See, Warburg was born in Germany. He understood banking as it was practiced in Europe. He eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company. He was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And he had maintained very close relationships and business liaison with his brother, Max Warburg, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the world at that time. And those of you who are Little Orphan Annie fans, you will remember the character Daddy Warbucks. Okay? Well, Paul Warburg was the real Daddy Warbucks. Everyone knew it at the time. And if you look at his picture, which I have in the book, you can see a resemblance between Daddy Warbucks and Paul Warburg. Cartoon characters, if anybody has ever played Monopoly, you remember that little character, the monopolist, the capitalist, with the handlebar mustache and stogie cigar, that's J.P. Morgan. So, okay, those were the seven men. They are the ones that were in that railroad car and at that meeting. And as incredible as it is, they represented directly or indirectly approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world at that time. Seven men who sat around the table and for 9 days created the Federal Reserve System. Now for the skeptics here, who are probably thinking, did it really happen that way? Wondering if maybe Griffin isn't exaggerating a little bit to make some kind of a point. I'd like to put your mind at ease on that, or perhaps I'm going to put your mind into a state of worry over this, by showing to you that this really did happen that way. And to illustrate that point, I'd like to quote an excerpt from an article that was written by Frank Vanderlip himself, one of the attendees at the meeting. It appeared in the Saturday Evening Post on February 9, 1935. This is what Vanderlip said. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. We were told to leave our last names behind us. We were told further that we should avoid dining together on the night of our departure. We were instructed to come one at a time, and as unobtrusively as possible, to the railroad terminal on the New Jersey littoral of the Hudson, where Senator Aldridge's private car would be in readiness, attached to the rear end of a train to the south. Once aboard the private car, we began to observe the taboo that had been fixed on last names. We addressed one another as Ben, Paul, Nelson, and Abe. Davison and I adopted even deeper disguises, abandoning our first names. On the theory that we were always right, he became Wilbur and I became Orville, after those two aviation pioneers, the Wright brothers. The servants and train crew may have known the identities of one or two of us, but they did not know all. And it was the names of all printed together that would have made our mysterious journey significant in Washington, in Wall Street, even in London. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen. Well, why not? What's the big deal about a group of bankers, even important, wealthy bankers, getting together and talking about banking or banking legislation. The answer is provided by Vanderlip himself in the same article. He said, if it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had got together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress. Why not? Because the purpose of the banking bill was to break the grip of the money trust. And ladies and gentlemen, it was written by the money trust. It's as simple as that. Had this been known from the beginning, the scam would have been exposed, and we would never have had a Federal Reserve system. That was like putting the fox in charge of building the hen house and installing the security system. So that was the reason for the secrecy. It was essential to keep the reality from public knowledge that this bill, supposedly to break the grip of the money trust, was conceived and hammered together by the money trust itself. Now that should alert us to something. Wait a minute, what's going on here? Let's take another look at this thing that they created. What were they trying to do? Well, you know, there's something else about that group that's extremely significant. If you just think about it for a minute, who they represented and who they were, here we have the Rockefellers, the Morgans, Kuhn Loeb Company, the Rothschilds, and the Warburgs, out that grouping, all sitting down around a table, coming to an agreement. Ladies and gentlemen, these were competitors. These were the giants in the field of financial markets in those days. These are the ones who had been previously butting their heads against each other for dominance. Blood all over the battlefield. What are competitors doing sitting down and coming to an agreement? What possible agreement could that be? This is extremely significant because it happened in precisely that period of American history when big business was making an important transition away from free market, free enterprise competition into monopoly. We were going from free enterprise capitalism into monopoly capitalism. It was John D. Rockefeller the first who said it. He said, competition is a sin. He is quoted in this way by all of his biographers. Of course they believed competition was a sin. And his whole life and the life of these people eventually became dedicated to the elimination of competition. And for the 15-year period prior to this meeting on Jekyll Island, these groups increasingly had been coming together and working through joint ventures rather than competing with each other. And what happened on Jekyll Island was merely the culmination of that process. They came together, ladies and gentlemen, and formed a cartel. Very important realization to understand what the Federal Reserve System is. Now, I should define a cartel so at least you'll know what I mean when I use the word. A cartel is a group of independent businesses which come together for the purpose of eliminating competition between themselves in order to enhance their profits or to secure their position in the market. And they do this by a number of means. Price fixing is one. Or they can divide up markets or products and services. They may say, for example, we get the North and you get the South and we won't compete. Or they may say, we'll produce the widget and you produce the gizmo and we won't compete. Or they may say, we'll share patents and processes. And by one agreement after another, layered on top of each other, these independent businesses gradually become one. Insofar as the public is concerned. It's a shared monopoly that they create in a cartel to enhance their profits and secure their position in the market. The other side of that coin, of course, is that the public pays more for those products or services than it would otherwise. And a banking cartel is no different than any other kind of a cartel. I remember some years ago when the milk cartel, which is called the Dairy Association, got together and got Congress to pass a law to protect the people from high milk prices. See, the cartels always protect the people. That's how they get their cartel agreements embodied into law. Well, I happen to know a little bit about the milk prices and the cartel in those days, and I knew that in those areas, a lot of areas in the country, the cost of milk was 15 or 18% less than it was after the public was protected by price fixing. Anyway, this is how it works, and that's how it works with the banking cartel. So the reality, ladies and gentlemen, is that the Federal Reserve System not only was a scam in the sense that it was the fox protecting the chickens, the money group protecting the country against the money group, that here they were forming a cartel right under the noses of the American people, and nobody ever caught wind of it. Oh, something else about this group and what they did there, essential to the final understanding of what they created. This cartel, ladies and gentlemen, went into partnership with the government. Extremely important to understand. Now, cartels often go into partnership with the government. They often get them involved to enforce their cartel agreements through law, but in this case, they did it in spades. Now, with any partnership, there has to be a benefit to both partners. Otherwise, they don't go into it or they don't stay in it. So we should take a look now at what the benefit or the payoff is to these two partners, government on the one side and the private banking cartel on the other. What do they get out of it? And to answer that question, we're going to take a look at how the Federal Reserve System creates money. It's what I call the Mandrake mechanism. If those of you who are old enough to remember back in the 40s, there was a cartoon character called Mandrake the Magician. And he had the knack of being able to materialize things out of nothing. And then when he waved his cape, they disappeared back into nothing. And I thought, boy, that's it. That's the name for the mechanism that the Federal Reserve uses. So I'm calling this the Mandrake mechanism. They have more technical names in the banking journals, if you're interested. I'm going to tell you how it works. Now, I'm going to simplify this and try to get this down to just plain old English. We're going to get Epictetus out of this completely. And it may sound like I've oversimplified, but believe me, ladies and gentlemen, everything I'm going to tell you is 100% accurate in reality. I also want to warn you in advance, don't try and figure this out. Two, you're going to blow a fuse, because if you try and figure it out, you'll be saying, well, how does this work? I mean, it doesn't make sense. Just remember, it's a scam. If you keep that in mind, then it becomes very, very clear. And it starts with the government side of the partnership. It starts with Congress. Congress needs extra money over and above what it collects in taxes. It spends a lot of money there, and they never have enough that they get from the people. So in essence, they go to the Treasury Department. The treasurer says, hey, you guys have got to be kidding. We don't have any money here. You spent it all a long time ago. Everything that we took in taxes is gone. And they say, well, that's not a big problem, because what we'll do is we'll borrow it. Whatever we need extra, we'll just borrow it from the people. So together they go down the street to the printing office and they print up some certificates, very fancy things, and they put across the top of them United States Treasury bond or bill or whatever, and they offer them to the public. And, of course, the public lines up and is very willing to lend money to the government in return for those IOUs, because they get this promise of interest payments. And they know they're going to get paid their interest, because those bonds are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. Which means that the United States government pledges that in order to pay that interest, if it has to, it'll take everything you've got in order to pay that interest. That's what it means to be backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. So these people know that, and they say, well, if the government's going to take it from me, at least I might as well get on the other side and get a little bit of it back in interest. So they lend money to the government and play that game. And that works up to a point, but they never lend enough. Congress really needs big money. So when they run short, even on the loaning side, they say not to worry. They go further down the street to the Federal Reserve building. Walk in, and the Fed has been waiting for them because that's why it was there, or one of the reasons it was made. The Federal Reserve officer opens up his desk drawer, pulls out his big checkbook, and he writes a check to the United States Treasury for $1 billion, or whatever the amount is that Congress wants that day. And he signs it. Now let's just pause there for a moment and ask a question. Where did the Federal Reserve get that money? Who put the money into this account that they can write a $1 billion check? The Treasury. And the amazing answer is, there is no account. Absolutely no account. There is no money there at all. They just write a check. And at that instant, that $1 billion just springs into being out of thin air. To that. Now, if you and I were to do that, we would go to jail, of course. But they can do it because Congress wants them to do it. This is the deal. This is the payoff. This is how Congress gets its instant, unlimited money. No matter what it wants, it knows it can get it. Have you noticed something interesting about Congress? It's been many years since they have even questioned what anything costs. It's not an issue. It doesn't make any difference what the cost is. Regardless of how much more it is than what they take in taxes or can borrow, they can go down the street, and by law, the Federal Reserve is required to write that check and create the money out of nothing and give it to the government. Now, Congress knows that maybe not in their frontal lobe, but back in the back lobe somewhere, they know that if they had to go to the public and raise all this money through direct taxes, they'd be thrown out of office. But if they can get it through this mechanism, why, people don't even know that they're being taxed. And they even think these fellows are great because they're doing all of these wonderful things for the people. So Congress likes it very well, and that is basically the payoff to the government, on the government side of the partnership. But now, let's take a look at the other side, the private banks in the cartel. If you think this is bizarre so far, wait till you hear the rest of this. So the Treasury takes this $1 billion check and deposits it into its checking account in a Federal Reserve Bank, of course. And instantly, of course, all of the computers show that the federal government now has $1 billion deposited into its checkbook. So the federal government can now write checks against that $1 billion deposit, which it does very well. So it starts writing checks, you know, $100 million for some foreign dictator. They send money over to the International Monetary Fund. They pay the bill at the United Nations. They buy a few votes with welfare benefits. They invade some little country. Whatever's in the national interest. For the sake of understanding this mandrake mechanism, let's just take a look at $100 of this billion that is paid to the postal worker, the person who delivers our mail. Now, he gets a $100 check, and he's looking at this thing, and he's happy to have it, of course, but he doesn't dream in his wildest imaginations that just 2 days ago, that money didn't exist anywhere in the universe. You can't imagine that. And he really wouldn't care if you told him, because he can spend it. So he takes it to his bank and deposits it into his checking account. Now the action heats up, because now we're out of the government side, and we've finally got a little bit of this money into the commercial banking side. And it always gets over there in the next step, of course. No matter where the government spends it, it always, in the next step, winds up in the commercial banking system. Whoever the government gives it to has to take it and deposit it into their checking account somewhere with a commercial bank, a member of the cartel. So we're just looking at $100 of that billion. Now, the local banker sees that $100 and he says, oh, glory in the morning. He runs over to the loan window, opens it up, and he says, attention everybody, we have money to loan. And of course people line up because that's one of the reasons they're there. Some people put money into the bank and some people take money out of the bank. In fact, more people take money out of the bank than put money into the bank, as you'll see in a moment. There's more money that goes out than comes in. Impossible in this crazy world. Here's how it works. You figure the banker has a $100 deposit, and you might think that, well, he can loan $100. No, he can loan up to $900 based on that $100 deposit. That makes sense, doesn't it? And the reason for that is that according to the Federal Reserve requirements, the bank is required to keep only 10% of its deposits in reserve. All it has to do basically is classify this $100 as a reserve, and we've got $100 reserve, which is 10% of $1,000, so the balance, the difference of $900, it can loan. Now, it doesn't happen quite that simply in one step. You have to go through a lot of steps to make it happen. But it happens exactly that way. They can loan up to $900 for every $100 that is deposited into a checking account. Now, where did that money come from? What account? And the answer is exactly the same as before. There is no account. There is no money at all. That $900 springs into being precisely at the point at which it is loaned to the borrower. Notice the difference here. On the government side, the money created, the $1 billion created and given to the government spends for its own projects. However, the $9 billion that the commercial banks create, on the other side, the banks don't spend it for their projects, but they loan it to the borrower for their project. Well, how does the bank make out on this then? Well, the bank makes out on it because they collect interest on it. Interest on nothing. That's not too shabby either. I'd like to have a magic checkbook like that, where I didn't have to have any money in any account anyplace, just write checks all day long, $10,000, $20,000, $100,000, and loan these checks out and collect interest on it forever. Not too bad. So now you see the payoff on the banking side. Everybody's making money out of nothing and benefiting from it. And the American out here doesn't know anything about this process. Doesn't know what's going on. It's all been explained to him by Epictetus, and he figures, oh, I better leave that up to the experts. Well, the process doesn't stop there, of course. This money, created out of nothing, goes out into the economy, and it dilutes down the value of the dollars that are already out there. It's like pouring water into the soup. The soup gets weaker and weaker. The value of the dollar gets weaker and weaker, and so it takes more and more of it to buy anything, and that's, of course, the phenomenon we call inflation, which is the appearance of rising prices. And I say it's the appearance of rising prices because, in reality, prices do not rise. What is happening is that the value of the dollar is going down. That's the real phenomenon. The money had been based on, if it had been real money, in other words, if it had been based on something tangible, like gold or silver or anything else of intrinsic value, which the politicians and the banks could not just create out of nothing, then you would see that real prices in terms of real money would remain extremely stable over long periods of time. And to illustrate that point, it's interesting to realize that had we lived in ancient Rome and had a 1 ounce gold coin, we would have been able to buy a very fine toga, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. And today, if we have a 1 ounce gold coin, we can go into any men's store and buy a very fine suit, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. The real price for these items has not changed in thousands of years when expressed in terms of real money. But these things that we carry around, we call them dollars, but they're not. They're really Federal Reserve notes. They buy less and less and less because they're being created more and more and more, and their value goes down, down, and down. So we're losing purchasing power through this phenomenon of inflation. Nobody asks, or too few people ask, who is getting this purchasing power? We know we lost it. Who got it? Nobody thinks about it. Well, it just happens. It's sort of like death. It happens. Nothing we can do about it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, somebody gets that purchasing power that we lose. And if you follow this trail to the end, you realize that those who got this purchasing power are those who spent the newly created money first. Those who get the money at the point at which it is injected into the pot of soup have full purchasing power of it. But by the time it goes from hand to hand and moves out toward the edge of the pot where you and I are, it's diluted down and we've lost purchasing power. So those who get the purchasing power, the ones who first spend the money, who are they? Well, on the one side, of course, there's the government, because they get that $1 billion check and they're the first ones to spend it. That's the beginning of the whole process. The government gets it. Who else? Well, who are the people that get it through the banking system? The borrowers. The people who borrow money and spend it real fast are ahead of the game, at least as long as the economy is expanding. Of course, if it starts to contract and this whole thing can go the other way, then it flip-flops. They're the ones that are losing purchasing power. But at least in the beginning, the borrowers are the ones who gain, but they don't get to keep their gains because they have to pay most of it to the bank in the form of interest on nothing. So now we're finally to the guy who gets the gain, which is the bank. So who gains? The very people who are in this partnership. The government and the banking cartel are the ones who are getting our lost purchasing power. It's that simple. Just realize that this process of inflation is a tax. It's a very real tax, just as real as the income tax or the excise tax. In fact, even more real because it's more cruel. It's the most cruel tax of all, most unfair tax of all, because it falls most heavily on those who can least afford to pay it. It falls on those who are on fixed incomes, those who are retired, those who have saved their money. And it falls on the working man who has to live hand to mouth. He doesn't have much savings. You may wonder, how does he suffer? He gets his cost of living pay raises now and then, but remember, he gets it after the fact, not ahead of the fact. He's always trying to catch up with his lost purchasing power, always at the tail end of the thing. He's at the edge of the pot. I'm a contractor, you're doing okay. If you're working for a living in almost any other capacity, you're paying a tax to the government and to the banking cartel. So if you remember nothing else about this presentation, I hope you will remember that. Tax the American people an unlimited amount through the hidden power of inflation without the voter even knowing that he's paying a tax. And on the banking side, they're able to collect interest on nothing. That is the payoff. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you understand the Federal Reserve System. Never been taught in any economics textbook. Let's now go back to Jekyll Island, because something else happened there that's rather interesting. They had to name their creature. This partnership between government and banks was not new with the Federal Reserve System. It was created, invented in Europe in the 16th century, and was finally perfected with the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. From that point forward, all of the governments of Europe used this partnership mechanism, or what I call the Mandrake mechanism, and for a very good reason. The kings and princes of Europe had discovered that they could tax their subjects only so high, usually about 40, 42, 43%, and then they had a revolt on their hands. They just couldn't go any higher than that. But once they discovered the Mandrake mechanism, ooh-wee, there was a whole different ballgame. They could now tax through inflation, and their subjects did not resent it because they didn't know they were paying the tax. With the invention of the Mandrake mechanism in Europe, that we saw a great upwelling in the number, intensity, and cost of wars, because wars are very expensive. Had the subjects of Europe been taxed directly for those wars, I doubt if most of them would have been fought. But now that these governments were able to tax their subjects through inflation, wars became a way of life in Europe. The aim for this Mandrake mechanism that they used in Europe was a central bank. And that's still the correct phrase used in textbooks today to describe it. If you want to look it up in a book or in an encyclopedia, that's what you look it up under, central bank. So now, when these men met on Jekyll Island, they were very clear in their mind that they wanted to create a central bank, just as they had in Europe, but they didn't know what to call it because Congress, you see, was already on record as saying they didn't want a central bank. So the guys on Jekyll Island said, well, what are we going to call our central bank so that no one will know it's a central bank? And they came up with a pretty good strategy. They said, well, first of all, let's call it federal. That'll make it sound like it's government. Next, let's add the word reserve. That'll make it sound like it's got a reserve somewhere. We'll add the word system. And that was more important than it might seem because, remember, one of the great concerns was this concentration of power in New York. And so they were talking about diffusing this power away from New York over a system of banks all over the country. They decided, first they talked about creating 10 regional banks, and they said, no, that's not enough. 12 we'll go for. We'll call these regional Federal Reserve banks, and we can build big buildings there, and people can go and look at these buildings and say how magnificent they are, and be convinced that finally the grip of Wall Street has been broken, because look at all these banks we've got around in all the various states. So the concept of system was essential. Of course, something that is not federal, there are no reserves, it's not a system in the sense of diffusion of power, and these regional banks aren't even banks. On all four words, you see, we have appearances of the fourth kind. So having devised a good name for their creature, the next step was to sell it to Congress and sell it to the people. The first draft of the Federal Reserve Act was called the Aldrich Bill, obviously sponsored by Senator Aldrich. And this was against the good advice of Paul Warburg, who told Aldrich that he should not do that. He said, you know, Nelson, if you put your name on this bill, it's going to be defeated because you are so closely identified with banking interests and big business interests. And apparently Aldrich's ego was too big. He must have said that, well, no, I'm highly respected in the Senate, and I am, after all, the chairman of the National Monetary Commission. So he put his name on the bill, And Warburg was right. Thumbs down in Congress. So that was a minor setback. They took their bill, scrambled the paragraphs around a little bit, took Aldridge's name off, and found a couple of Democrats to sponsor the bill. Now that was different, you see, because Aldridge was a Republican, and everyone knew that the Republicans represented big business. But everyone also knew that the Democrats represented the common man, the working man, the fellow on the assembly line. You know, like Ted Kennedy. So they found a couple of millionaire Democrats to sponsor the bill. They got Carter Glass in the House and Senator Robert Owen, who was himself a banker. And now that it was a Democrat bill, this was a different story. So it began to get more favorable consideration. Next, Aldridge and Vanderlip, both of whom were at the meeting, remember, went around the country and began giving speeches condemning the bill. This will ruin the banks. This will be destructive to the nation. And by the time the little guy read that in his newspaper, he was saying, ah, the big bankers don't like it. Must be a pretty good bill. Exactly what happened. You see, these fellows didn't get to be where they were by being stupid. They were brilliant strategists. They understood mass psychology. They understood politics. And they played their cards exceedingly well. Meanwhile, these same individuals were the ones who were financing the support for the bill. They paid for the creation of so-called study groups that sprang up all over the nation, held public meetings and published pamphlets and brochures extolling the virtues of the Federal Reserve Act. They gave large donations to some major universities. They created new departments of economics. They appointed their own people as professors in those departments, and then those professors went around the country giving speeches and writing scholarly essays on the virtues of the Federal Reserve Act. And as a final gesture, it was Paul Warburg who insisted that they add a few provisions to the bill which seriously restricted the power of the Federal Reserve System, limited its ability to create money out of nothing. And some of his associates said to him, Paul, what are you doing? We don't want these things in the bill. And his response was this. He said, hey guys, don't you get it? Relax. Our object here is not to get everything all at once. Our object is to get the bill passed. We can fix it up later. Because of provisions like that, that they won the support of William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the great populist movement. I don't think he was very bright. He looked at those measures and he said, oh, well, those are good provisions. I guess with those protective provisions in the Act, I can support. And he did. And Warburg was right. They fixed it up later. Since the Federal Reserve Act was passed, it has been amended over 100 times. And no one has noticed. Everyone was looking in 1913, reading the bill, trying to understand it. But after it was passed, amendments come and go and nobody cares. All of those protective restrictions were long ago removed, and many new ones, many new provisions have been added, which greatly expand the power of the Federal Reserve System. And so with this kind of brilliant and professional strategy, tactics, deception, it's not surprising that the Federal Reserve System became very popular among the American people and among congressmen, and remains so today for pretty much the same reason. And so on December 22nd, 1913, Congress passed the bill, and President Woodrow Wilson signed it into law the next day, and the creature from Jekyll Island finally moved in to Washington, D.C. Let's just step back for a moment and see what we got. Let's take a look at this creature. We got a corporation which was chartered by Congress and given the exclusive franchise to create the nation's money. We got a mechanism whereby Congress has been able to raise unlimited taxes from the people through this process of inflation without us even knowing, for the most part, that we're paying the tax. And we got a mechanism whereby the banks can earn interest on nothing. That is the creature from Jekyll Island. I'd like to turn my attention now to the question of who owns the Federal Reserve System, a very popular question, a very heated issue that comes through some of these talk shows, if you've heard them lately. I've heard it so many times, somebody will call in and say, did you know that the Federal Reserve System is a private corporation? It's not a government agency. It's a private corporation. What we need to do is abolish it and turn it over to the Congress or to the Treasury where the people can control it. If I'm driving down the road, I almost go off the road every time I hear this. I want to stop and get on the telephone and call in. Because you see, this is, well, first of all, it's a half-truth, and then it's a non-solution. It's a half-truth in the fact that the Federal Reserve is not an agency of the federal government. That's true. Not at all. As I said a moment ago, it's a corporation which was chartered by Congress, and with all corporations, it has stock certificates. And those certificates are held, in this case, by the member banks within the system. All the banks have to put in a certain amount of capital, and then they get a stock certificate in proportion to the amount of capital they get. So up until this point, it looks as though it's a private corporation. But that's as far as the similarity goes. Because these stock certificates do not carry with them the usual powers of private ownership, the usual prerogatives of ownership. In reality, they're merely just receipts for the money that the member banks put in. They don't really carry any rights with them whatsoever. For example, the holders of these certificates cannot sell them. Well, if you don't have the power to sell something, you don't really own it. That's the test of ownership, is how you dispose of it. Furthermore, regardless of how much capital that the individual banks put in, they all have just one vote, which is another violation of the principle of private ownership. Even so, that vote doesn't buy anything to speak of any importance. They can only vote for some of the members of the board of directors of their regional branches. They have no voice whatsoever in the selection of the board of directors or the chairman at the national level, which is where the power is, where all the major decisions are made. Those people are appointed by the president, you see. Furthermore, the national board appoints the chairman and the vice chairman of all the regional branches. And the president and all of the officers of the regional branches, even though they can be elected by the regional banks, they can be vetoed by the national board. So you see, all power, meaningful power, is in the national board in Washington. And these people at the branches have absolutely nothing to do except clear checks, a lot of mechanical things going on. The only policy decision the regional banks, so-called, are allowed to make is to set the interest rates within their region, and even that can be overridden by the national board if they don't like it. So the bottom line is that the regions, the regional branches, have absolutely no say-so in the management and operation of the Federal Reserve System. So it is not a private corporation in the traditional sense of the word, nor is it a government agency in the traditional sense of the word. Well, it's a hybrid. It's a unique structure. It's half government, half private. And you see, it is exactly what you would expect it to be, considering the reality of its function. It is a partnership, remember, between government and private banks. It is, in fact, a hybrid structure performing a hybrid function. You would expect the organization itself to be a hybrid. So that's what it is. Well, what happens if we just abolish it and turn it over to the Treasury or the Congress to oversee? What have we accomplished with that? You see, it's not a question of who owns the stock. It's a question of what it does. As long as it is a central bank, in other words, as long as it has the ability to create money out of nothing, it makes little difference whether it's done technically by the banks or by the Congress. It's still the same mechanism going on, and the same scam continues. It would be run by the same people, and they would do the same thing. Remember that all of the governments of Europe, all of the central banks of Europe, are in fact direct agencies of those respective governments. They don't have a hybrid relationship over there. And all of those central banks continue to do exactly the same thing that the Federal Reserve System does here. Congress is a non-solution. And it would be so easy to whip up support for something like that and say, boy, we've solved the problem, but in fact we have not solved anything. And you just to follow the same agenda. Well, what is that agenda? We are told that the purpose of the Federal Reserve System is to stabilize the economy and put an end to chaotic banking that existed prior to its inception. One of the more commonly used textbooks in the schools today is written by Paul Samuelson, a book on economics, and this is what he says. He says, the Federal Reserve sprang from the panic of 1907 with its alarming epidemic of bank failures. The country was fed up once and for all with the anarchy of unstable private banking. That's what they're teaching. That's pretty much what I think I remembered learning when I went to school. And yet it's doing for us, putting an end to unstable private banking and protecting the economy, stabilizing it. Well, that's its stated objective. Let's see how well it has done in achieving its objectives. We'll give it a report card. Since it was created in 1913, it has presided over the crashes of 1921 and 1929, the Great Depression of 29 through 39, recessions in the years 53, 57, 69, 75, and 81, a stock market Black Monday in 87. Looks like we might have another Black Monday someday soon, the way it's going. We all know that corporate debt is soaring. Personal debt is greater than ever. Both business and personal bankruptcies are at an all-time high. Banks and savings and loan associations have failed in larger numbers than ever before in our history. Interest on the national debt is now consuming half of our tax dollars. Heavy industry has all but been replaced by overseas competition. We're faced with an international trade deficit for the first time in our history, and it's getting worse every month. 75% of downtown Los Angeles and other major metropolitan areas is now owned by foreigners, and half of the nation is now officially in a state of recession. Now, that's the scoreboard after 80 years of stabilizing our economy. And I don't think it's even controversial that the Federal Reserve System has failed to meet its stated objectives. The only controversial part is, why has it failed? And my answer to that is because the stated objectives are not its true objectives. What are its true objectives? They are the same as any cartel's objectives, which is to improve the profit margins of the members of the cartel and to stabilize their position in the market. Period. Possible? Could something that crass be going on under our noses? It doesn't take much investigation to illustrate this point. During the time when the period of history about which we're speaking, 1900 through 1913, the bankers did a lot of writing about some of the problems that face banking, and they had solutions that they proposed for it. And it was clear that they had several things that they wanted to accomplish. I'll just mention two of them here. First, they wanted to stop the erosion of their power away from the East Coast. In other words, the very thing that the Federal Reserve System was supposed to accomplish is the very thing they wanted to prevent. And they set the Federal Reserve System up to to accomplish just the opposite of what we were told it was to accomplish. They were concerned over the fact that as the nation moved westward and southward, new banks were springing up along the frontier, and more capital was moving out in that direction. Now, they still had the lion's share of the market, but they could see the charts every year a little less percentage-wise, and they knew that they had to put an end to that trend then, while they still had the power to do so. Remember, these little banks were competition. And as Rockefeller said, competition is a sin. And this is a good point to emphasize, that when I'm talking about the banking cartel, I'm not talking about the little banks. I'm talking about these big mega banks in New York. These are the ones that created the cartel, and part of the victims all along have been the smaller banks who have been trying to compete with the mega banks. A process that's been going on ever since, and you can see the fallout really happening quickly today as the small banks are being gobbled up, merged with, and purchased by the larger banks. And this is all happening because of regulations and pressures that are brought to bear on these smaller banks by the Federal Reserve System. And this was one of the objectives when the Federal Reserve Act was written. And another objective which I'd like to mention is they were concerned over what they called private capital formation. Now, that's banker language for the fact that businesses were more and more beginning to finance their expansion out of their own savings rather than going to the bank and taking out loans for it. Holding dividend payments a little bit from their stockholders every quarter, putting it into a sinking fund, and then when they had enough money saved up, then and only then would they build the new factory or launch into the development project or whatever. And the banks were very concerned over this trend. They wanted to reverse it. They wanted to bring businesses back to the banks for borrowed capital. And they knew that the only way they could do that was to lower interest rates, to make it so attractive that businessmen would be silly not to come in and borrow money. Well, how can you lower interest rates? See, this is a real challenge. You just can't arbitrarily do that when you have real money. And in these days, they had real money. The money was backed by gold and silver. And they couldn't just create it out of thin air. And under those conditions, interest rates seek their own natural level in response to the forces of supply and demand. You cannot control interest rates. The free market controls interest rates under those conditions. And so the bankers were saying, how can we upset this balance? How can we artificially tip interest rates lower than they are? And they said the way to do that is by having what they call a flexible currency. That's the phrase they used then, and in fact they still use that phrase in the banking textbooks today. A flexible currency. Well, what does that mean? You need a dictionary to understand these words. A flexible currency, ladies and gentlemen, means money made out of nothing. That's what that means. So they wanted a flexible currency. Why? Well, you see, if you're creating money out of nothing, you don't have to charge an awful lot of interest on it to make a profit. So the more money they could make out of nothing, in other words, the more flexible the currency, the more they could lower the interest rates below the natural level, and they would be able to entice the businessmen back into the banks. So that was objective number two. There were others, but in the interest of time, I'll just stop with those. Now let's ask what kind of report card they get on those two objectives. Did they keep control of the banking system in New York? And the answer, of course, is yes. Not some pretty big banks out in the Midwest and the West Coast, but they're small potatoes compared to these mega banks in New York. The very banks or their descendants which created the cartel now dominate the world with branch offices in Peking and Moscow and everywhere in the world. A couple of years ago, there was a book that was published by Simon & Schuster. It was called Secrets of the Temple, written by William Grider. It was a bestseller. And it was advertised as a scathing attack against the Federal Reserve System. Well, I couldn't believe my ears. I thought to myself, a scathing attack against the Federal Reserve System published by Simon & Schuster, one of the biggies? How did this be? I couldn't believe it. So I literally ran to the bookstore to get my copy, and I read it, and I was amazed at two things. The first thing that amazed me was that Greider had done his homework and had a lot of excellent history in there. I was familiar with much of, about which he was speaking because I was researching it at the very time, and Greider had it all there. I couldn't believe my eyes. I'd like to just read for you a short quotation from Greider about this issue of concentration of power in New York. Now remember, this is published by Simon & Schuster, so it must be true. This is what Greider said. He said, at the time, the conventional wisdom in Congress was that the government institution would finally harness the money trust, disarm its powers, and establish broad democratic control over money and credit. The results were nearly the opposite. The money reforms enacted in 1913, in fact, helped to preserve the status quo, to stabilize the old order. Money center bankers would not only gain dominance over the new central bank, but would also enjoy new insulation against instability and their own decline. Once the Fed was in operation, the steady diffusion of financial power halted. Wall Street maintained its dominant position and even enhanced it. I'm absolutely right on that point. The other thing that amazed me about his book was his conclusion. What are we going to do about this? Here we had a big, thick book, fully documented, proving beyond any doubt that the Federal Reserve had always worked against the public interest. Furthermore, proving that it was designed to do that from the very beginning. So what does he suggest we do about it? Abolish the Fed? No, nothing that extreme. How about a major overhaul? No, not necessary, says Greider. His solution was this. He said, basically, you see, folks, it's all so complicated. But we're working on it. We're learning as we go. Relax. It's under control. All we need now are wiser men. You see, this is the kind of powder puff criticism it takes to be published by Simon & Schuster. It doesn't make any difference how accurate you are with your history. It doesn't make any difference how much you point with alarm, how much you expose all of the evil doing, as long as you don't offer any meaningful solution to the problem. This is controlled opposition, something that we have to be very aware of, especially today. Look around you. How much controlled opposition do you see? It doesn't make any difference how much you point with alarm and point out how evil things are going, what's going on in Washington today. If your only solution is vote Republican, relax, folks, everything's under control. All we need now are wiser men. You've had it. Controlled opposition. I'd like to give a 3-hour lecture on that someday. Federal Reserve gets an A for maintaining control over the financial markets in New York. What about reversing the trend toward private capital formation? Well, that's the very thing that has caused so many businesses to go bankrupt. Businesses have been enticed to borrow up to the hilt by attractive interest rates. And then when the economy shakes a little bit, they cannot survive. They've gone out of business because they cannot service their debt. And many companies which remain in business today are hanging on by their teeth because they cannot service their debt. You realize that today many companies send more money every quarter to the banks in the form of interest on their loans than they send to the stockholders in the form of dividends on the stock. Think about that for a minute. The banks, who created the money out of nothing, make more money out of these industries than the people who earned the money, worked for it, saved it, sacrificed it, risked it, and bought the stock. And I said the Federal Reserve gets an A for reversing the trend toward private capital formation. Well, these actions have consequences. We're looking now at a national debt which exceeds, well, it's approximately at $5 trillion. In my mind, it greatly exceeds $5 trillion because that does not account for all of the off-budget items. I think if you include our obligations over which Congress no longer has any control, the automatic built-in future spending, you'd be looking at a deficit of about four times that figure. Let's just take a look at $5 trillion. What is that all about? Had a stack of $100 bills, 40 inches high, you'd be a millionaire. But a stack of $100 bills totaling $5 trillion would rise into space 3,350 miles. We still don't know how much $5 trillion is, but we do know what its impact on us is. Since the Federal Reserve was created, we have had approximately 1,000% inflation of our money supply, known inflation that we know about. Another way of saying that is that a dollar of 1913 today will purchase about 9 cents worth of goods. The government and the banking cartel got all of that money multiplied by all of those dollars. Let's talk briefly about usury, and then I'm going to wrap it up with a quick look into the future. We'll look at where this money is going, what it's being used for, how we can stop it. I just want to leave this thought with you on the topic of usury. It's a real interesting subject. You know, in ancient times, usury was defined as interest on a loan. Period. Any interest on any loan was usury. Modern times, it's been redefined to mean excessive interest on a loan. In recognition of the fact that if we work for our money and we save it, we forego the pleasure of its use, and then we loan it to somebody for their venture, we're entitled to a reasonable compensation for that sacrifice. Reasonable interest payments seem logical to us and fair. Nobody questions it. But what about excessive interest? What is that? Well, Thomas Edison said, people who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work. And I wondered at the time if that was true, so I got my calculator out, and by golly, it was. If you take an assumption of a $100,000 house to be built, and the buyer has to pay $70,000 for building materials and labor, and he takes out he puts a $30,000 down payment, a good hefty down payment. We could make this example even worse by going for a smaller down, but he puts a $30,000 down payment, goes to the bank, takes out an 11% loan over 30 years. We punch in the numbers and we find that he will pay in interest to the bank $167,806 compared to $70,000 paid for labor and materials. In other words, he will pay approximately two and a half times more money to banks than to those who provide all the labor and provide all the materials. But don't forget the time value of money. After all, people work for this money, they save this money, they're entitled to be compensated. Oh, wait a minute, not this money. No. Contract. Nobody worked for this money. Nobody saved this money. Nobody risked this money. This money was created out of nothing. And I suggest that $167,806 interest on nothing is excessive. I think it's about time that we come up with a new definition for the word usury. Any interest on any loan of fiat money, meaning money created. That's just a $100,000 house we're talking about. $167,000 $1,806 interest on just one house. Now multiply that in your mind by all the houses in America, by all the factories in America, all the high-rise office buildings, all the inventories, all the machinery, all the farm equipment, all the farm buildings, all the dollars out there. Can you picture in your mind this river of wealth flowing? It's so wide you can't even see across it. And it's flowing perpetually into the coffers of the banking cartel. Unearned wealth. Staggering, isn't it? And that's why I say the Federal Reserve System is the supreme instrument. What are they doing with it? Ladies and gentlemen, they are not buying more mansions or yachts with it. They have all of those that they possibly can use a long time ago. In fact, they abandoned them on Jekyll Island. They got bored with those mansions there. That's not it. When a person has all the wealth they can possibly use for the material pleasures of life, what is left? And it's power, isn't it? Power is what excites these people. What they are doing, ladies and gentlemen, they're using this money to acquire power over you and over me and our children. They are literally buying up the world. And I don't mean that they're buying up the real estate or the hardware. They're buying up control over you and me through the organizations and the institutions through which we live and work, our power centers. We act as groups in everything we do. A few people are kind of hermits. They live out there alone. They're totally independent. But most of us act in groups, and we follow leaders. And they have been acquiring control over our leaders in these groups. In other words, they have been buying up control of political parties, publishers, newspapers, TV networks, wire services, universities, church organizations, labor unions, you name any kind of an organization through which people work, live, move, or seek information. And this is where those people have been concentrating and spending their money for many, many years, acquiring control over them. This process has been going on outside of the United States at a rate much more accelerated than inside. Yes, they've been doing the same thing in the industrialized nations of the world, but have you taken a look at the so-called third world lately? Ever wondered what they're doing with that huge amount of money that we send to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank? And they say that they're loaning it or giving it to the underdeveloped nations so that they can raise their standard of living. Believe that? Well, if it's true, they're not doing a very good job, are they? Because, you know, after having done this for, 50 years or so, there's not one underdeveloped country out there yet which has had its standard of living raised one iota by all that money. Not one. And in fact, many of them are worse off. And that is not an accident. Because that money does not go to the people. It does not go to the businesses, which might have a chance of raising the standard of living. It goes to the governments of those nations. It goes, in other words, to the politicians. The tin horn dictatorships who control those countries with an iron hand. And that money is used to consolidate their control over the people. To build bigger and more efficient governmental structures of control. That's these people, the ones in control, the ones at the top, couldn't care less about the standard of living of their subjects as long as they have their mansions and their yachts and their limousines and their jet airplanes, and they get to go to New York to the United Nations meetings and strut around. They have exactly what they want, and their political cronies back home who support them are well taken care of. Their support mechanism is financed by our money through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And these people, these political parties and groups have been purchased. There's no way in the world that they're going to go against that flow of money. They'd be crazy to walk away from that and say, no, we don't want your money, we're going to do it ourselves. Those nations have been purchased, and we've paid most of the bill. Countries are right now firmly in place in the New World Order. It has to show up, and we're getting closer all the time. Part of this process not only is just sending money away from us to them to solidify their control over the people, but the other side of that is to drain us of resources to lower our standard of living so that we can eventually become just like they are. When people are hungry, when they're out of work, when they're desperate, when they have chaos on the streets, they will subject themselves to incredible controls. And that is where we're at. The name of this game is not wealth. It is power. But what are we going to do about it? Well, we're going to get out of this mess, if we get out of it at all, the same way we got in, which is through Congress. Congress enacted the Federal Reserve Act. It can abolish the Federal Reserve system anytime a majority of the congressmen decide they want to do it. Our job, therefore, is to convince a majority of the congressmen that they want to do it. We have the power to do that. If we just tackle Congress one district at a time, you know how few people, how few people it really takes to affect an election? I'm not talking about partisan politics here. This has got nothing to do with the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. We're just talking about citizen action. If just the people in this room got out and worked like your very life and freedom depended on it, which it does, you could turn the election in your district for or against any congressman. Look at the political party structure that puts them into office. They're usually the little precinct organizations they have. They're paltry. They're nothing. One of the great things about the operation of the Birch Society is this program called TRIM. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. I'm not here to promote TRIM or the Birch Society, but I must tell you this, that this little program, Tax Reform Immediately is what TRIM stands for, is a great program for getting these big spenders out of Congress. I hope that they'll mention this at the end of the talk and show you how that works. But basically, they distribute a little report card on the congressman's voting record to everybody they can reach within his district. And it just has 8 or 16 of the key issues that were in Congress in the last session. And it shows what those issues were and how the congressman voted. Did he vote for big government and more taxes? In which case he gets an X after that. Or did he vote for less government and lower taxes? In which case he or she gets a star. And of course most of these guys get a lot of X's and very few stars. And by distributing this through the congressional districts, they put them in newspapers. I mean, when you open up your Sunday newspaper, out drops this little report card on your congressman. I mean, everybody sees it. People don't have to know about Jekyll Island or the Mandrake mechanism. They can see that this fellow is spending their money. And it works. It's getting these big spenders out of Congress. It's involved in the TRIM program. It's easy to do. It's very easy to do. Of course, on the other side, you know, it doesn't make any difference if you had the best congressman in the world running for office. People probably wouldn't understand what he was talking about at the present level of enlightenment among the electorate. Have to enlighten the electorate. As boring as that may seem, it'd be much more fun, I suppose, or more exciting to grab your guns and groceries and head to the hills or something. We'll make our last stand, you know, over here when the blue helmets show up. Boy, we'll really be on guard. Meanwhile, we're not doing anything, you know. No, that's more exciting, but the real action now is in educating our fellow Americans, because only if we do that can we expect to turn Congress around. That's where the John Birch Society comes in. It's an educational organization. Check into it if you don't know more about it.